Chapter 6. It's a Saturday in June, and I'm going to meet Bella for brunch. We haven't seen each other in almost 2 months, which is the longest we've ever gone, including her London sojourn of 2015, when she moved to Notting Hill for 6 weeks to paint. I've been buried in work. The job is great and impossible. Not hard, impossible. There is a week's worth of work in every day. I'm always behind. I see David for 5 minutes, maybe, every day when one of us wakes up sleepily to greet the other. At least we're on the same schedule. We're both working toward a life we want and will have. Thank God we understand each other. Today it's raining. It's been a wet spring, this one of 2025, so this is not out of the ordinary. But I ordered some new dresses and I was hoping to wear one. Bella is always calling my style conservative, because 90% of the time I'm in a suit, and I thought I'd surprise her with something unexpected today. No luck. Instead, I tug on jeans, a white Madewell t-shirt, and my Burberry trench and ankle rain boots. Temperature says 65 degrees. Enough to sweat with a top layer, but be freezing without one. We're meeting at Bouvette, a tiny French cafe in the West Village we've been going to for years. They have the best eggs and croque monsieur on the planet, and their coffee is strong and rich. Right now, I need a quart. Also, it's one of Bella's favorite spots. She knows all the waiters. When we were in our 20s, she'd go there to sketch. I end up taking a cab because I don't want to be late, even though I know Bella will be running 15 minutes behind. Bella is chronically 15 to 20 minutes late everywhere she goes. But when I arrive, she's already there, seated in the window at the two-top. She's dressed in a long, flowing floral dress that's wet at the edges. At 5'3", she's not tall enough for it, and a crimson velvet blazer. Her hair is down and falls around her in tufts like spools of wool. She's beautiful. Every time I see her, I'm reminded just how much. "This cannot possibly be happening," I say. "You beat me here?" She shrugs, her gold hoops bouncing against her neck. "I couldn't wait to see you." She gets out of her chair and pulls me into a tight hug. She smells like her, tea tree and lavender, a hint of cinnamon. "Oh, I'm wet," I yelp, but I don't let her go. "It feels good. I've missed you too." I tuck my umbrella under my chair and loop my raincoat over the back. Inside, it's chillier than I thought it would be. I rub my hands together. "You look older," she says. "Gee, thanks." "That's not what I mean. Coffee?" I nod. She holds her cup up to the waiter. She comes here far more often than I do. Her place is 3 blocks away on the corner of Bleecker and Charles, a floor-through level of a brownstone her dad bought for her 2 years ago. It's 3 bedrooms, impeccably decorated in her colorful bohemian, I didn't even think about this, but it looks gorgeous style. "What's darling Dave up to this morning?" she asks. "He went to the gym," I say, opening my napkin. "The gym?" I shrug. "That's what he said." Bella opens her mouth to say something, but closes it again. She likes David, or at least I think she does. I suspect she'd like me to be with someone more adventurous. Someone who maybe pushed me outside my comfort zone a little bit more. But what she doesn't realize, or what she conveniently forgets, is that she and I are not the same person. David is right for me and the things I want for my life. "So," I say, "tell me everything. How is work coming at the gallery? How is Europe?" 5 years ago, Bella did a show of her artwork at a small gallery in Chelsea named Oleander. The show sold out, and she did another. Then 2 years ago, Oleander, the owner, wanted to sell the place and came to her. She used her trust fund to buy it. She paints less than she used to, but I like that she has some stability in her life. The gallery has meant that she can't disappear anymore, at least not for weeks at a time. "We nearly sold out the Depressed show," she says. "I'm so bummed you missed it. It was spectacular, my favorite by far." Bella says that about every single artist she shows. It's always the best, the greatest, the most fun she's ever had. Life is an upward escalator. Business is so good, I'm thinking about hiring another Chloe. Chloe has been her assistant for the last 3 years and runs the logistics at Oleander. She's kissed Bella twice, which has not seemed to complicate their business relationship. You should do it. Might give me time to actually sculpt or paint again. It's been months. Sometimes you have to sacrifice to achieve your dreams. She smiles sideways at me. The coffee comes. I pour some cream into it and take a slow, heady sip. When I look up, she's still smiling at me. What? I ask. Nothing. You're just so... sacrifice to achieve your dreams. Who talks like that? Business leaders, heads of companies, CEOs. Bella rolls her eyes. When did you get like this? Do you ever remember my being any different? Bella puts her hand to her chin. She looks straight at me. I don't know, she says. I know what she means, but I never really want to talk about it. Was I different as a child, before my brother died? Was I spontaneous, carefree? Did I begin to plan my life so that no one would ever show up at my door and throw the whole thing off a cliff? Probably. But there isn't much to be done about it now. I am who I am. The waiter circles back to us, and Bella raises her eyebrows at me as if to ask, "You ready?" "You order," I say. She speaks to him entirely in French, pointing out items on the menu and discussing them. I love watching her speak French. She's so natural, so vibrant. She tried to teach me once in our early 20s, but it just didn't stick. They say that languages come better to people who are right-brained, but I'm not so sure. I think you need a certain looseness, a certain fluidity to speak another language. To take all the words in your brain and turn them over one by one, like stones, and find something else scrolled on the underside. We spent 4 days together in Paris once. We were 24. Bella was there for the summer taking an art course and falling in love with a waiter in the 14th arrondissement. I came to visit. We stayed at her parents' flat right on the Rue de Rivoli. Bella hated it. Ugh, tourist location, she told me, although the whole city seemed for the French and the French alone. We spent the entire 4 days on the outskirts, eating dinner at cafes on the fringe of Montmartre. During the day, we wandered in and out of galleries in the Marais. It was a magical trip, made all the more so by the fact that the only time I'd been out of the country was a trip to London with my parents and David, and my annual pilgrimage to Turks and Caicos with his parents. This was something else, foreign, ancient, a different world, and Bella fit right in. Maybe I should have felt disconnected from her. Here was this girl, my best friend, who fit this faraway place like a hand to a glove. I didn't, and yet she still took me with her. She was always taking me with her, wanting me to be a part of her wide-open life. How could I feel anything but lucky? To get back to the prior discussion, Bella says when the waiter is gone, I think sacrifice is in direct opposition to manifestation. If you want your dreams, you should look for abundance, not scarcity. I take a sip of coffee. Bella lives in a world I do not understand, populated by phrases and philosophies that apply only to people like her. People, maybe, who do not yet know tragedy. No one who has lost a sibling at 12 can say with a straight face, everything happens for a reason. Let's agree to disagree, I tell her. It has been too long since I've seen you. I want to be bored senseless hearing all about Jacques. She smiles. It sneaks up her cheeks until it's practically at her ears. What? I have something to tell you, she says. She reaches across the table and takes my hand. Instantly, I am flooded with a familiar sensation of pulling, like there's a tiny string inside of me that only she can find and thread. She's going to tell me she met someone. She's falling in love. I know the drill so well, I wish we could go through all the steps right here at this table with our coffee. Intrigue, obsession, distaste, desperation, apathy. What's his name? I ask. She rolls her eyes. Come on, she says. Am I that transparent? Only to me. She takes a sip of her sparkling water. His name is Greg. She lands hard on the one syllable. He's an architect. We met on Bumble. I nearly dropped my coffee. You have Bumble? Yes. I know you think I can meet someone buying milk at the deli, but I don't know. Lately, I've been wanting something different, and nothing's been that interesting in a while. I think about Bella's love life over the last few months. There was the photographer, Stephen Mills, but that was last summer, almost a year ago. Except Annabelle and Mario, I say, the collectors she had a brief fling with, a couple. She bats her eyes at me. Naturally, she says. So what's the deal? I ask. It has been like 3 weeks, she says. But Danny, he's wonderful, really wonderful. He's really nice and smart, and I think you're really going to like him. Nice and smart, I repeat. Greg? She nods, and just then our food appears in a cloud of smoke. There are eggs and caviar on crispy French bread, avocado toast, and a plate of delicate crepes dusted with powdered sugar. My mouth waters. More coffee? Our waiter asks. I nod. Yum, I say. This is perfect. I immediately cut into the avocado toast. The poached egg on top oozes out yolk, and I scoop a segment onto my plate. I make a vaguely pornographic noise through a mouthful. Bella watches me and laughs. You're so deprived, she says. I throw her a disgruntled look as I make my way to the crepes. I have a job. Yes, how is that going? She tilts her head to the side. It's great, I say. I want to add, some of us have to work for a living, but I don't. I learned a long time ago there is a difference with Bella and our relationship between judgmental and unkind. I try not to stray over the line. I think it's going to be another year and then partner. Bella does a little shimmy in her chair. Her sweater slips from where it sits on her shoulders, and I'm met with a slice of collarbone. Bella has always had a Zaftig figure, glorious in its curvature, but she looks slimmer to me today. Once during the month of Isaac, she lost 12 pounds. Greg, I already have a bad feeling.
I think we should all go to dinner, Bella says.
Who? She gives me a look.
Greg, she says.
She sucks her bottom lip in, lets it pop back out. Her blue eyes find mine.
Danny, I'm telling you, you don't have to believe me, but this one is different. It feels different.
They always do. She narrows her eyes at me, and I can tell I've crossed it. I sigh. Ugh, I can never quite say no to her. Okay, I say. Dinner. Pick any Saturday 2 weeks from now, and it's yours. I watch Bella as she loads up her plate, first eggs, then a crepe, and feel my stomach start to relax as she eats with gusto. The sky changes from rain to clouds to sunshine. When we leave, the streets are almost entirely dry. Chapter 7. What happened to the blue shirt? David comes out of our bedroom in a black button-down and dark jeans. We're already running late. We're supposed to be at Rubirosa in Soho in 10 minutes, and it will take us at least 20 to get downtown. Bella may always be late, but I still like beating her places. That's how we've always done things. Brunch was enough change for 1 week. You don't like this? David hunches down and surveys himself in the mirror above the sofa. It's fine, I just thought you were wearing the blue one. He heads back into the bedroom and I check my lipstick in the same mirror. I'm wearing a black sleeveless turtleneck and a blue silk skirt with heels. The weather says 67 degrees, low of 63, and I'm trying to decide whether to bring a jacket. He comes back in, buttoning the blue one. Happy? Very, I say. Will you call a car? David busies himself with his phone, and I check to make sure I have our keys, my cell phone, and Bella's gold-beaded bracelet. I borrowed it 6 months ago and never gave it back. 2 minutes. When we get to the restaurant, Bella is standing outside. My first instinct is confusion. She beat me again. My second is that it's already over with Greg and we're going to be having dinner alone. This has happened twice before. Gallery Daniel and, I think, bartender Daniel. I feel a wave of irritation, followed by one of sympathy and inevitability. Here we go again. Always the same thing. I get out of the car first. I'm sorry. I start just as the restaurant door opens and out onto the pavement walks Greg. Except he's not Greg. He's Aaron. Aaron. Aaron, whose face and name have been running in my head on a loop for the last 4.5 years. The center of so many questions and daydreams and forced replays made manifest on the sidewalk now. It wasn't a dream. Of course it wasn't. He's standing here now, and there is no one else he could be. Not a man I've spotted at the movies, not an associate I once traded work jobs with, not someone I shared a plane ride seated next to. He is only the man from the apartment. I reel back. I do not know whether to scream or run. Instead, I'm cemented. My feet have merged with the pavement. The answer? My best friend's boyfriend.
Babe, this is my best friend, Danny. Danny, this is Greg. She snuggles into him, her arms looping around his shoulders.
Hey, he says. I've heard a lot about you. He picks up my hand to shake it. I search his face for any sign of recognition, but of course I come up empty. Whatever has happened between us hasn't yet. David extends his hand. I'm just standing there, my mouth hanging open, neglecting to introduce him. This is David, I sputter. David in the blue shirt shakes Aaron in the white shirt's hand. Bella smiles. I feel as if all the air on the sidewalk has been sucked back into the sky. We're going to suffocate out here. Shall we? I follow Greg Aaron up the steps and into the crowded restaurant. Aaron Gregory, he says to the hostess. Aaron Gregory. I flash on his license in my hand. Of course. Aaron? Oh, yeah, my last name is Gregory. Greg just kind of stuck. He gives me a small smile. It feels too familiar. I don't like it. I feel like I'm sinking, like I'm falling through the floor, or maybe the floor is falling too, except no one else is moving. It's just me, catapulting through space. Time. Aaron. He looks at me, dead on. I hear David behind us laugh at something Bella has said. I smell her perfume, French rose, the kind you can only buy at the drugstores in Paris. I'm not one of the bad ones, he tells me. Just because I know you think I am. I exhale. I feel dizzy. I do? You do, he says. We start following the hostess. We snake around the bar in between the two top tables with couples bent together over pizza and deep glasses of red. I can tell by the way you're looking at me. And what Bella has said.
What has she said?
We pass through an archway and Aaron hangs back, holding his arm out to let me pass. My shoulder brushes his hand. This isn't happening. That she's dated some guys who maybe didn't treat her right. And that you're an amazing friend, and you're always there to pick up the pieces. And that I should be warned you'll probably hate me at first. We've arrived at the table. It's in the back room, pushed up against the left-hand wall. David and Bella are upon us.
I'll slide in the corner, Bella says.
She shoves herself in first and pulls me down next to her. David and Aaron sit across from us.
What's good here? Aaron asks.
He gives Bella a wide smile and reaches across the table for her hand. He strokes her knuckles. I don't need to look at the menu, but I do anyway. The arugula pizza and rubarosa salad are what we always get.
Everything, Bella says. She squeezes and releases his hand and shimmies her torso.
She's wearing a short black ruffled dress with roses on it that I bought with her on a shopping trip to the Couples. She has neon green suede heels tucked under her, and dangly green plastic earrings clank against her cheeks. I need to avoid Aaron's face, his entire person, him seated 12 inches across the table from me.
Bella tells us you're an architect, David says, and my heart squeezes with affection for him.
He always knows the things you're supposed to ask, how you're supposed to behave. He always remembers the protocol.
Indeed, Aaron says. I thought architects didn't really exist, I say. I'm keeping my eyes on the menu. Aaron laughs. I glance up at him. He points to his chest. Real. Pretty sure.
She's talking about this article Mindy Kaling wrote like a million years ago. She says that architects only exist in romantic comedies.
Bella rolls her eyes at me. She does? Aaron points to me.
No, Mindy, Bella says. Mindy says that.
I think it was in the Times, titled something like, Types of Women in Romantic Comedies Who Are Not Real. The architect thing was anecdotal. Incidentally, Mindy also said that a workaholic and an ethereal dream girl were not believable stereotypes either, yet here we are. No, handsome architects, I say, to clarify. Bella laughs. She leans across the table and touches Aaron's hand.
That's about as close to a compliment as you're going to get, so enjoy it.
Well, then, thank you. My dad's an architect, David says, but no one responds. We're now busying ourselves with the menu.
Do you guys want red or white? Bella asks.
Red, David and I say at the same time. We never drink white. Rosé occasionally in the summer, which it isn't yet. When the waiter comes over, Bella orders a Barolo. When we were in high school, we all took shots of Smirnoff while Bella poured Cabernet into a decanter. I've never been a big drinker. In school, it affected my ability to get up early and study or run before class, and now it does the same for work, only worse. Since I turned 30, even a glass of wine makes me groggy. And after the accident, no one was allowed to drink in our house, not even a thimbleful of wine. Completely dry. My parents still are, to this day. I'm in the mood for some meat, David says. We've never ordered anything other than the arugula or classic pizza here. Meat? I'd split a sausage with you, Aaron says. David smiles and looks at me. I never get sausage. I like this guy. I've been preoccupied, possessed, since I saw him on the sidewalk. For the first time, I consider the reality that this man is Bella's boyfriend. Not the guy from the premonition, but the one sitting across from her now. For one thing, he seems good and solid, funny and accommodating. It's usually like pulling teeth to get one of her boyfriends to make eye contact. If he were anyone else, I might be thrilled for her, but he isn't. Where do you live? I ask Aaron. I see flashes of the apartment, those big open walls, the bed that overlooked the city skyline.
Midtown, he says.
Midtown? He shrugs. It's close to my office. Excuse me, I say. I get up from the table and wind my way to the bathroom, which exits off a little hallway. What's going on? It's David on my heels. That was weird. Are you okay? I shake my head. I don't feel well. What happened? I look at him. His face is studying me with concern and something else. Surprise? It's close cousins with annoyance, but this is unusual behavior for me, so I'm not sure. Yeah, it just hit me. Can we go? He glances back into the restaurant as if his gaze will reach the table where Bella and Aaron sit, no doubt just as baffled. Are you going to throw up? Maybe. This does it. He springs into action, placing a hand on my lower back. I'll let them know. Meet me outside. I'll call a car. I nod. I head outside. The temperature has dropped markedly since we arrived. I should have brought a jacket. David comes out with my bag and Bella.
You hate him, she says. She crosses her arms in front of her chest.
What? No, I don't feel well.
It was pretty spontaneous. I know you. You once muscled through the full-blown flu to fly to Tokyo.
That was work, I say. I'm clutching my stomach. I'm actually going to vomit. It's all going to come out on her green suede shoes. I like him, David says. He looks to me. Danny does too. She had a fever earlier. We just didn't want to cancel. I feel a wave of affection for him for this lie.
I'll call you tomorrow, I tell her.
Go enjoy your dinner. Bella doesn't budge from her place on the sidewalk, but our car comes and David holds the door open for me. I dive inside. He walks around and then we're off down Mulberry, Bella disappearing behind us.
Do you think it's food poisoning? What did you eat? David asks.
Yeah, maybe. I lean my head against the window and David squeezes my shoulder before taking out his phone. When we get home, I change into sweats and crawl into bed. He comes and perches on the edge. Can I do anything? He asks me. He smooths down the comforter, and I grab his hand before he lifts it off. Lay down with me, I say.
You're probably contagious, he says. He puts the back of his hand on my cheek. I'm going to make you some tea.
I look at him, his brown eyes, the slight tufts of his hair. He never uses product, no matter how many times I tell him everyone needs it.
Go to sleep, he says. You'll feel better in the morning.
He's wrong, I think. I won't. But I fall asleep anyway. When I dream, I'm back in that apartment. The one with the windows and the blue chairs. Aaron isn't there. Instead, it's Bella. She finds his sweatpants in the top drawer of the dresser. She holds them up and shakes them at me. What are these doing here? She wants to know. I don't have an answer. But she keeps demanding one. She walks closer and closer to me. What are these doing here? Tell me, Danny. Tell me the truth. When I go to speak, I realize the entire apartment is filled with water, and I'm choking on everything I cannot say.
Chapter 8.
It's nice to see you again, Dr. Christine says. The plant is still there. I assume now that it's fake. Too much time has passed.
Yes, well, I say, I don't really know who else to tell.
Tell what?
The truth of what I've learned. That what I saw in that apartment is from the future. It will occur in exactly 5 months and 19 days on December 15th. I graduated as valedictorian of Harriton High, magna cum laude from Yale, and top of my law class at Columbia. I'm not gullible, nor am I a fool. What happened wasn't a dream. It was a premonition, a prophecy sketched to life. And now I need to know how and why it happened so I can make sure it never does. I met the man, I tell her, from the dream. She swallows. It could be my imagination, but it seems like it's taking some effort. I want to skip this part, the part where we have to determine what it is and how it happened, the process. The part where she thinks I'm maybe a little bit crazy, hallucinating possibly, working out past trauma, etc. I'm only interested in prevention now. How do you know it was him? I give her a look. I didn't tell you we slept together. Oh. She leans forward in her brown leather chair. Unlike the plant, it's new. That seems an important part. Why do you think you left it out? Because I'm engaged, I tell her, obviously. She leans forward. Not to me? I don't know, I say. I just didn't. But I know it's him, and he's now dating my best friend. Dr. Christine looks at her notes. Bella. I nod, although I don't remember talking about her. I must have. She's very important to you. Yes.
And you feel guilty now.
Well, technically, I haven't done anything wrong.
She squints at me. I put a fist to my forehead and hold it there.
You mentioned you're engaged, she says, to the same man you were with when we last spoke?
Yes. It has been over 4 years since I saw you. Do you have plans to get married?
Some couples decide not to.
She nods. Is that what you and David have decided? Look, I say, I just want to make sure this doesn't happen again, or happen at all. That's why I'm here. Dr. Christine sits back as if creating more space between us. A pathway to the door, maybe.
Danny, she says, I think something is going on that you don't understand, and that is frightening to you as someone whose actual job it is to discover and prove causality.
Causality, I repeat.
If I do this, I'll get this result. She holds out her hands like a weighted Grecian scale. This experience does not fit in your life. You have not taken any steps to have it, and yet, here it is.
Well, right, I say. That's why I need it to not be.
And how do you propose you do that?
I don't know, I say. That's kind of why I'm here. Predictably, our time is up. I decide I need to go in search of the apartment. I need something concrete, some form of evidence. Sunday, David heads into the office and I tell him I'm going for a run. I used to run all the time in my 20s, long runs, down the West Side Highway and through the financial district, between the tall buildings and across the cobblestones. I've run the loop in Central Park, around the reservoir, watching the leaves change from green to yellow to amber, the water reflecting the seasons. I've run 2 marathons and 6 halves. Running does all the things for me it does for everyone else. Clears my head, gives me time to think, makes my body feel good and loose. But it also has the added benefit of taking me places. When I first moved to the city, I could only afford to live in Hell's Kitchen. But I wanted to be everywhere, so I ran. In the early days of our relationship, I used to try to get David to come with me, but he'd want to stop after a few blocks and get bagels, so I started leaving him at home. Running is better alone anyway. More space to think. It's 9 a.m. by the time I cross the Brooklyn Bridge, but it's Sunday, early, so there aren't that many tourists out yet. Just bikers and other joggers. I keep my head high, shoulders back, focusing on my core pulling forward. My breathing is ragged. It has been too long since I've been on a long run, and I feel my lungs rebelling against the exertion. I never saw the outside of the building, but from the view, I'd have to place it somewhere close to the water, maybe near Plymouth. I get over the bridge and slow to a walk as I make my way down Washington Street toward the river. The sun has started to burn off the haze of the morning, and the water reflects in sparkles. I take off my sweatshirt and tie it around my waist. Dumbo, short for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass, used to be a ferry landing and still has an industrial feel. Large warehouse buildings mix with overpriced grocer markets and all-glass apartment buildings. As my breathing slows, I realize I should have done a search before I came down. Apartment views, open listings. I could have made a spreadsheet and gone through it. Why didn't I think of that? I stop in front of Brooklyn Bridge Park, in front of a brick and glass building that takes up the entire block. Not it. I pull out my phone. Do I buy this apartment? I make good money, more than most of my peers, but a $2 million one-bedroom loft seems out of my price range, at least in the next 6 months. And it doesn't make any logistical sense. We have our dream place in Gramercy big enough to put a kid in someday. Why would I want to be here? My stomach starts to rumble, and I walk west to see if I can find somewhere to grab an apple or a bagel and think. I turn up Bridge Street, and after a few blocks, I find a deli with a black awning, Bridge Coffee Shop. It's a tiny place with a counter deli and a board menu. There's a police officer there. That's how you know it's good. A woman with a wide smile stands behind the counter and converses in Spanish with a young mother with a sleeping baby. When they spot me, they wave goodbye to each other, and the woman wheels her baby out. I hold the door open for her. I order a bagel with white fish salad, my usual. The woman behind the counter nods in solidarity with my order. A man comes in and pays for a coffee. 2 teenagers get bagels with cream cheese. Everyone here is a regular. Everyone says hello. My bagel sandwich comes up for pickup. I take the white paper bag, thank the woman, and make my way back down toward the water. Brooklyn Bridge Park is less a park and more a stretch of grass. The benches are full, and I pop down on a rock right by the water's edge. I open up my sandwich and take a bite. It's good. Really good. Surprisingly close to Sarge's. I look out over the water. I've always loved the water. I've had little of it over the course of my life, but when I was younger, we used to spend July 4th week at the Jersey Shore in Margate, a beach town that is practically an extended suburb of Philadelphia if you go by population.
My parents would rent a condo, and for 7 blissful days, we'd eat shaved ice and run the crowded shore with hundreds of other kids, our parents happily situated in their beach chairs, watching from the sand. There was the night in Ocean City, on the rides, spinning on the Sizzler or riding the bumper cars, the dinner at Mac and Manco Pizza, and cheese hoagies from Sacco Subs, dripping in oil and red wine vinegar, opened in paper at the beach. Michael, my brother, gave me my first cigarette there, smoked under the boardwalk, nothing but the taste of freedom between us and our fingertips. We stopped going after we lost him. I'm not sure why, except that everything that felt familial, that seemed to tie us together, was intolerable. Like our joy or unity was a betrayal of him, his life.
Danny?
I close my eyes and open them again. When I look up, I see him standing above me in a bike helmet, half on his seat. Aaron, you've got to be kidding me.
Chapter 9.
Hi. Wow. I scramble to my feet, shoving my sandwich back into the bag. What are you doing down here?
He's wearing a blue t-shirt and khaki pants, a brown leather messenger bag slung over his chest.
It's my weekend bike route.
He gestures to his bag, shakes his head.
No, Bella actually sent me on an errand this morning.
Oh, yeah? Aaron unclips his helmet. The line of his hair is wet and matted down with sweat.
You seem to be feeling better.
I put my hands on my hips.
I am.
He smiles.
Good. You want to come?
Where? He scoots himself closer.
I'm looking at an apartment.
Of course he is. I didn't need a Google search, I just needed Aaron to show up right now and lead me there.
Let me guess, I say. Plymouth Street?
Close, he says.
Bridge.
This is insane, this is not happening.
Yes, I say. I'll come.
Great. He loops his helmet over his handlebars and we start walking.
You're a runner? He asks me.
I used to be, I say. I can feel the sting in my left knee and hip as we walk, a product of not enough stretching and no squats before taking off.
I know. I don't get on my bike as much as I like anymore either.
Why isn't Bella here? I ask.
She had to go into the gallery, he says. She asked me to check it out. You'll get it when you see it, I think. Hang on.
We're at a crosswalk and he holds his hand back as 2 bikers speed by.
Try not to die on my watch, huh?
I blink back at him in the sunlight. I should have worn sunglasses.
Okay, now we can go.
We cross the street and then we're making our way up Plymouth until we get right to where it meets Bridge, running perpendicular, just where I came from. And then I see it. I missed it on my walk just now, blinded by my search for a sandwich. It's the red brick event space with the barn door. I recognize it now. But not just from that night. I was at a wedding here 3 years ago. David's friends Brianne and Andrea from Wharton Business School. It's the old Galapagos art space, and it's what I saw out the window that night 4.5 years ago. And behind me, across the street at 37 Bridge, is the building Aaron is about to lead me into.
Watch your step, he says, as we cross the street and make our way to the door.
Sure enough, I'm right. It's a brick and concrete building, less industrial than some surrounding it. There's no lobby, just a buzzer and a padlock, and Aaron takes a ring of keys from his messenger bag and begins trying them. The first 2 don't work, and then on the 3rd, the lock swings open, the chain coming undone in his hands. The steel door swings open to reveal the side of a freight elevator. Aaron uses a 2nd key to call it down for us, this time on the 1st try.
They're expecting you? I ask.
Aaron nods.
A buddy of mine is a broker and gave me the keys. Said we could check it out today.
We. Bella. The elevator lumbers down. Aaron holds the door open and I step inside. Then he wheels his bike in after us. He hits the button for the 4th floor and we're making our way upward, the mechanics of the freight heaving and sputtering as we go.
This building doesn't seem up to code, I say, crossing my arms.
Aaron smiles.
I like that you and Bella are best friends. It's fun.
What?
I cough twice into my closed fist. What do you mean?
You're so different.
But I don't have time to respond because the doors are opening, delivering us straight into the apartment from 4.5 years ago. I know immediately, without having to take a step inside, that it's the one. Of course it is. Where else did I think this morning would deposit me? But the apartment isn't at all what it was, or will be. It's a construction site. Old wood beams sit piled in a corner. Plumbing and wires hang unfinished from outlets. There's a wall where I do not remember one being. No appliances, no running water. The space is raw, open, honest. Not a stitch of makeup on.
Job for an architect, I say. I get it now.
But Aaron hasn't heard me. He's busy leaning his bike up against a wall, where I remember the kitchen being, and stepping back to survey the place. I watch him cross the apartment, walk over to the windows. He turns around, taking in the long view.
Bella wants to live here? I ask.
Her apartment is perfect, an actual dream. She bought it before it even came to market fully renovated. She has 3 bedrooms, floor-to-ceiling windows, and a galley kitchen. I can't understand her wanting to move. She decorated that place for 2 full years. She still claims to not be done. But Bella has always been one for a project. She loves potential, possibility, and unknown terrain such as this one. The only trouble is she rarely, if ever, sees anything through. I've seen her spend obscene amounts of money on projects and renovations that never ultimately come together. There was the Paris apartment, the LA loft, the jewelry line, the Thai silk scarf company, the shared artist space in Greenpoint. The list is long.
She does, Aaron says, or at least see if she can.
He's speaking quietly. His attention isn't on his words, but instead on his surroundings. I can see him sketching, drawing, molding this place to life in his head. They've only been together 2 months, 8 weeks. Granted, that's 2 weeks longer than Bella's longest relationship, but still, David didn't even know my middle name at the end of 2 months. The fact that Aaron is here, looking at a place for Bella to live, that he's tapping the walls and stomping the floorboards, it gives me pause. Whatever level they're at this quickly isn't good.
Seems like a big project, I say.
Not too big, he says. There are good bones here, and Bella tells me she likes a project.
I know that, I say.
At this, he looks at me. He turns his entire attention toward me, my lone figure standing in this swampy, sweaty space, clad in black running pants and an old camp t-shirt, while the potential of the future hangs around us like storm clouds.
I know you do, he says. It's softer than I imagined whatever he'd say would be. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
He takes a step closer to me. I inhale.
The truth is, I saw you go into the deli. I circled around and followed you back to the water.
He rubs a hand over his forehead.
I wasn't sure if I should say hi, but I really do want you to like me. I feel like we got off on the wrong foot, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to change that.
I back away.
No, I say, it's not, no, it's okay.
He gives me another lopsided smile, but this one looks hesitant, almost embarrassed.
Look, I don't need to be loved by everyone, but it would be nice if my girlfriend's best friend could stand to be in the same room as me, you know?
This room, this apartment, this unfulfilled space. I nod.
Yeah, I say, I know.
He brightens at this. We can take things slow, no meals for a while, maybe just start with some sparkling water, work our way up to a coffee. I try for a smile. To anyone else, that would have been funny.
Sounds good, I say. It feels physically impossible to say something interesting.
Great. He holds my gaze for a beat.
Bella's gonna flip when I tell her I ran into you. What are the odds?
In a city of 9 million, less than 0. He goes over to where wires hang unaccompanied off walls.
What do you think of putting the
kitchen? I offer.
He smiles.
Exactly.
And you could do the bedroom back there.
He points toward the windows.
I bet we could get a sick walk-in closet.
We walk through the apartment for another 5 minutes. Aaron takes some photos as he goes. When we head back down the elevator, my cell phone is ringing. It's Bella.
Greg texted me. How crazy is that? What were you even doing down there? You never run in Brooklyn. What did you think of the place?
She stops, and I can hear her breathing, shallow and expectant through the phone.
It's nice, I guess, I say.
But your place is perfect. Why would you want to move?
Ugh, you hate it.
I think about lying to her, about telling her I don't like it, that the windows have the wrong view, that it smells like trash, that it's too far. I've never lied to Bella, and I do not want to, but she also can't buy this place. She can't move here. It's for her protection as well as my own.
It just seems like a lot of work, I tell her, and kind of far.
She exhales. I can feel her annoyance.
From what? She says. No one lives in Manhattan anymore. It's so stuffy, I can't believe I do. You need to be a little more open-minded.
Well, I say, I don't really have to be anything. I'm not going to be the one living there.
Chapter 10.
David, we need to get married. It's the following Friday, and David and I are on the couch trying to decide what to order for dinner. It's past 10 p.m. We had a reservation for 2 hours ago, but one of us had to work later, and then the other decided to do the same. We got home 10 minutes ago and collapsed jointly onto the sofa.
Now? David asks.
He takes off his glasses and looks around. He never uses the bottom of his t-shirt because he thinks it smudges the lenses more. He makes a move to get up and go in search of a cleaner when I grab his hand.
No, I'm serious.
Me too. David sits back down.
Danny, I've asked you before to set a date. We talked about it. You never think it's the right time.
That's not fair, I say. We've both felt that way.
David sighs. Do you really want to talk about this?
I nod. Life has been busy, yes, but it's not true to say postponing things has come from us equally. I've been okay with waiting because it's what you want. David has been patient. We've never spoken about it, not in so many words, but I know he's wondered, why hasn't it happened? Why do we never talk about it? Not in specifics. Life got busy and it was easy for me to pretend he didn't think about it a lot. And maybe he didn't.
David has always been fine with my being in the driver's seat when it comes to our relationship. He knows it's where I feel comfortable, and he's happy to let me have it. It's one of the reasons we work so well.
You're right, I say. I take both of his hands in mine now. The glasses dangle awkwardly from his pointer finger, an unfortunate third wheel. But I'm saying it's time now. Let's do it.
David squints at me. He understands now that I'm serious.
You've been acting really weird lately, he says.
I'm proposing here.
We're already engaged.
David, I say, come on.
At this, he stops.
Proposing, he says. I took you to the Rainbow Room. This is pretty lame.
You're right. Still holding his hands, I slide down off the couch until I'm on one knee. His eyes widen in amusement.
David Rosen. From the first minute I saw you at 10 Bells in that blue blazer with your headphones in, I knew you were the one.
I have a flash of him, young professional, haircut too short, smiling awkwardly at me.
I wasn't wearing headphones.
Yes, you were. You told me it was too loud in there.
It is too loud in there, David says.
I know, I say, shaking his hands. His glasses fall. I pick them up and put them on the sofa next to him. It is too loud in there. I love that we both know that, and that we agree that movies should be 20 minutes shorter. I love that we both hate slow walkers and that you think watching reruns is a waste of time value. I love that you use the term time value.
To be fair, that's
David, I say. I drop his hands and place both my palms on either side of his face.
Marry me. Let's do it. For real this time. I love you.
He looks at me. His naked green eyes look into mine. I feel my breath suspend. One, two.
Okay, he says. Okay? Okay. He laughs and reaches for me. My lips meet his, and then we're in a tangle of limbs making our way to the floor. David sits up and bangs into the coffee table. Shit. Ow. It's wood with a glass top and tends to come off its hinges unless you move the whole thing in one piece. We stop what we're doing to attend to the table. Watch the corners, I say. We pick it up and set it back down, nudging the top into formation on the base. Once it's done, we stare at each other from either end of the table, breathing hard. Tanny, he says, why now? I don't tell him what I can't, of course. What Dr. Christine accused me of withholding. That the reason I've been avoiding our forever is the same reason it needs to happen now, without delay. That in forging one path, I am, in fact, ensuring another never comes to fruition. Instead, I say this. It's time, David. We fit together. I love you. What more do you need? I'm ready. And I'm sorry it took me so long. And that's true, too. As true as anything is. Just that, he says. His face looks happier than I've seen it in years. He takes my hand, and despite the 3 feet now between the couch and the coffee table, he leads me deliberately, slowly into the bedroom. He nudges me back gently until I'm just perched on the bed. I love you too, he says, in case it wasn't obvious. It is, I say. I know. He undresses me with an intention that hasn't been there in a long time. Usually when we have sex, we don't do a lot of mood setting. We're not particularly imaginative, and we're always pressed for time. The sex David and I have is good. Great, even. It always has been. We work well together. We communicated early and often, and we know what works. David is thoughtful and generous, and although I'm not sure I'd call us ambitious, there is a certain competitive edge to our lovemaking that never lets it feel stale or boring. But tonight is different. With his right hand, he reaches forward and begins to unbutton my shirt. His knuckles are cool, and I shiver against him. My shirt is an old white button-down J.Crew. Boring. Predictable. He'll be met with a nude bra underneath. Same old. But what's happening here tonight feels anything but. He keeps unbuttoning. He takes his time, threading the silk knobs through their eye slits until the whole thing comes undone at the waist. I shimmy my shoulders until it's off and falls to the floor. David puts one hand on my stomach, and with the other, he threads a thumb into the seam of my skirt. He holds me in place as he unzips it. This is less of a slow burn. It comes off in one swoop, falling into a puddle at my feet. I stand up and step out of it. My bra and underwear don't match. They're both Natori, although the bra is nude cotton and the underwear is black silk. I dispense with both and then push him down onto the bed. I lean forward over him, my breast grazing the side of his face. He reaches out and bites it. Ow, I say. Ow. He puts both of his hands on my back and runs them down slowly. That hurt? Yes. Since when are you a biter? Since never, he says. Sorry. He reaches out and kisses me. It's a slow and deep kiss, meant to recenter us. It works. David is working on his shirt, his hands on the buttons. I put mine over his and stop him. What? He asks. He's out of breath, his chest straining. I don't say anything. When he tries to stand, I put my hands on his shoulders and nudge him back down. Danny, he whispers. I answer by guiding his hand to my stomach and then down, down, until I feel that concave spot that makes me inhale. I hold his hand there. He looks at me, first confusion, then recognition dawning as I press his hand back and then forward, back and then forward. I take my hand away from his and grab onto his shoulders. He's breathing along with me, and I close my eyes against the rhythm, his hand, the incoming collapse that is mine, and mine alone. Afterward, we lie in bed together. We're both on our phones, looking up venues. Should we tell people? David asks. I pause, but What I say is, of course, we're getting married. He looks at me.
Right. When do you want to do it?
Soon, I say. We've waited so long already.
Next month?
David laughs. It's a sincere laugh, guttural, the kind I love from him.
You're funny, he says.
I put down my phone and roll to him.
What?
Oh, you're serious. Danny, you're not serious.
Of course I am.
He shakes his head. Not even you could plan and execute a wedding in a month.
Who says we have to have a wedding?
He raises his eyebrows at me, then squints them together.
Your mother? Mine? Come on, Danny, this is ridiculous. We've waited 4.5 years. We can't just elope now. Are you kidding? Because I really can't tell.
I just want to get it done.
How romantic, he deadpans.
You know what I mean.
David sets his phone down.
He looks at me.
I don't, actually. You love planning. That's like your whole thing. You once planned a Thanksgiving down to pee breaks.
Yeah, well,
Danny, I want to get married too. But let's do it the right way. Let's do it our way, okay?
He looks at me waiting for an answer. But I can't give him one. Not the one he wants. I don't have time for our way. I don't have time to plan. We have 5 months. 5 months until I'm living in an apartment my best friend wants to buy with the boyfriend she wants to buy it with. I need to stop this. I need to do whatever I can to make sure it never comes true. I'll be a planning machine, I say. It's all I'm going to focus on. How does December sound? We can have a holiday wedding to match our holiday proposal. It'll be festive.
We're Jews, David says. He's back on his phone.
Maybe it'll snow, I say, ignoring him. David, December? I don't want to wait.
This makes him stop.
He shakes his head, leans over, and kisses my shoulder blade.
I know I've won.
December?
I nod.
Okay, he says.
December it is.